Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds. I have the privilege of introducing our speaker, Dr. Mitchell Carl. Mitchell is a clinical cardiologist practicing at Boca Regional. Dr. Carl did his undergraduate work at Emory University. He went to medical school at Downstate. He did his internal medicine and cardiology fellowship at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx. He had several teaching awards, including best clinical house staff teacher from Albert Einstein School of Medicine. He has been involved in several clinical research projects at Boca Regional and has several publications and papers. He has academic appointments at FAU Medical School and also at Nova Southeastern. This morning, Dr. Carl's presentation is entitled Cardiomyopathy. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Carl.
Okay, so the thing that worries me the most, just to let you know, is being able to work these devices. So, Gary, don't go far. I guess this is the first slide. This is a patient who has a cardiomyopathy. No, I'm only kidding.
You jinxed it right from the beginning.
I didn't touch anything.
I know. It comes back alive.
These are the arteries and veins that lead to the weak. Oh, okay.
There you go.
All right.
And you're right on the playbook.
Okay. So first I'm going to show you guys some pictures, and then we'll get to the talk. So without further ado, so this is not a normal heart. So this is a patient who has a dilated cardiomyopathy. We're going to talk about the different types of cardiomyopathies in a few minutes. You can see that the morphology of the valves is pretty much normal. Basically what you have is a dilated left ventricle. Here's another example that's even more impressive with regard to the left ventricular dilatation. Left ventricle is here. You see it's significantly dilated and it's very hypocontractile. Sometimes you'll still, even if it's a diffuse process, you can still have segmental wall motion abnormalities, but often you don't. This is a patient that has a restrictive cardiomyopathy. This is what amyloid can look like. You can see the sort of the speckled myocardium pattern, and often sometimes there won't even be hypertrophy with restrictive cardiomyopathy. Sometimes there is. This is a patient that has actually a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy with a large outflow gradient. What happens to cause that usually, you can see here there is also some mitral annular calcification. The left ventricular systolic function is normal. This is another example here. You can actually see the systolic anterior motion of the mitral valve. So during systole, it abuts the anterior septum being thicker than the posterior wall. The hallmark of true hypertrophic obstructive myopathy is a septum that's much larger by 1.5 to 1 from the posterior wall. This is a patient that has a arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy. So the important thing is you can see the dilated right heart. And sometimes those patients present with arrhythmias, and sometimes they actually, believe it or not, can present with left heart failure, which we're going to see when we go further. Okay.
And now you can use the clicker if you want.
Which one do I hit? This one right there?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So we're going to discuss today cardiomyopathy. Definitions, types, how to make the diagnosis, and treatment considerations. So cardiomyopathy can probably best be defined as a variety of different disorders that share the common final pathway of being able to attack or decrease myocyte function, either by doing something to the interstitial areas surrounding the cardiomyocyte or attacking the myocyte in a function in some way directly. So things that decrease heart function by changing the loading characteristics of the ventricle, so things like hypertension, aortic stenosis, ischemia, which can produce an ischemic cardiomyopathy sort of, or ischemic LV dysfunction, technically by most definitions do not count for cardiomyopathy because they're not primary problems with the heart muscle. Likewise, congenital heart disease, which can often change with ventricular septal defects, et cetera, the loading conditions of the ventricle, that is also excluded from most definitions of cardiomyopathy. And finally, infiltrative processes that are malignancies, such either primary or secondary, by almost all definitions, do not count as a cardiomyopathy. So despite that, and we're going to go over some of the different work groups that have different definitions of cardiomyopathy, despite that, the terminology is still very commonly used. That people say ischemic cardiomyopathy, non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. To a large extent, that's used because there's really no alternative. I mean, people don't use the term in general, or perhaps they should, ischemic left ventricular dysfunction. But really, by the classic definitions, there really is no such thing as an ischemic cardiomyopathy, though as recently as 2013, the American College of Cardiology still calls it ischemic cardiomyopathy. And it's particularly prevalent in the electrophysiology literature, where in some of their studies to determine who gets or who doesn't get ICDs, it actually refers to ischemic and non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. And it's very prevalent in the North America literature still to use that terminology. So in terms of anatomic and physiologic classifications, there's really a big problem. And the big problem is that there's a tremendous degree of overlap phenotypically, independent of what the cause of the cardiomyopathy is. So there's genetic and acquired causes, and they can overlap. The phenotypic expressions for those can overlap. And then I give some examples here. So amyloid cardiomyopathy may present as a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It is also what most of us would think of as a classic restrictive cardiomyopathy. It also can produce a dilated cardiomyopathy, where really the dilatation is out of proportion to the degree of hypertrophy. And cardiac sarcoidosis can present as a focal abnormality of the myocardium, or it can actually spread to the entire myocardium and look like a dilated or a restrictive cardiomyopathy. It's commonly thought of as a restrictive cardiomyopathy. And finally, ARVD, which is arrhythmic right ventricular dysplasia, also called arrhythmic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, can affect only the right ventricle, but in up to 75% of cases, there is left ventricular involvement. And sometimes that can produce a dilated cardiomyopathy, so the patient is not presenting with arrhythmias, they're presenting with congestive heart failure. So in 1995, the World Health Organization and the International Society and Federation of Cardiology presented a classification system that's still in use. And with that, so the main five types of cardiomyopathy, and we're going to discuss them in further detail. The first one is a dilated cardiomyopathy that I showed in the first couple of slides. That's the heart that's significantly enlarged and diffusely hypocontractile. Then there's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. By the way, I may say some of these things twice, and if I do, it'll hopefully sink in more, which is good. So dilated cardiomyopathy is actually not the most common type of cardiomyopathy. It's the most commonly recognized cardiomyopathy, but it actually occurs about 1 in 2,500. That's its overall prevalence in our population. And hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is actually the most common type of cardiomyopathy. It occurs about 1 in 500. Restrictive cardiomyopathy can be very rare or very common, depending upon where you're talking about. In our country, it's very rare, but we're going to see later on that in certain other countries, it's very common. And then we're going to discuss some unclassified cardiomyopathies. Now, there's still other major society classification schemes that are out there and are really common and still in use. So one looks at primary versus secondary cardiomyopathy. Primary cardiomyopathy would be something that affects the heart muscle itself and has no effect on any other organ system. And then there are secondary cardiomyopathies, which are part of usually a syndrome or a disease, and are more diffuse, but also have a specific function on the heart that qualifies them as being a cardiomyopathy. Another classification scheme looks at whether or not it's genetic, whether it's mixed or acquired. And I put down the AHA and the ESC because both of them are very specific in excluding the things that we discussed before that are not based on primary abnormalities with the heart. So they specifically exclude hypertension, valvular heart disease, ischemic heart disease, congenital heart disease, and any malignancies, primary or secondary, from the terminology that is consistent with cardiomyopathy. And finally, I mentioned the MOGIS system, which is not widely used, and what that is, and it probably is going to turn out to be the most applicable, because what they do there is the M stands for morphology. So, you know, we're saying, is the morphology more of constriction, of restrictive cardiomyopathy? Is it more of a hypertrophic, more of a dilated cardiomyopathy? That's where you put the morphology of what you're seeing, like on those echocardiograms. And then the O stands for organ system involvement. So if it's a systemic disease, it's a secondary cardiomyopathy, it would say like O, K plus B. And that would mean, well, the organ involves the kidney and the brain, in addition to, of course, the heart. And then the G is whether it has a predominantly genetic basis. And E is other etiologies. So, you know, a lot of times what we're finding is that it's not really one thing that produces the cardiomyopathy. A lot of times these patients have some genetic reason to have it, and then there's some environmental problem in addition to it, and you need both in order to display the phenotype, which winds up being the cardiomyopathy. So first I'm going to talk a little bit more about dilated cardiomyopathy. So it's characterized by dilatation and hypocontractility of one or more ventricles. It can be both, but it usually involves the left ventricle. The clinical features are those of heart failure when the dominant presentation is that of conduction abnormalities or arrhythmias, either atrial or ventricular, then you have to think of one of three gene problems, which are very common causes of cardiomyopathy that result in arrhythmias. So there's desmosomal gene abnormalities, which are very common in people with arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia or cardiomyopathy. And then there's ion channel myopathies, and we're going to talk about them in a little more detail coming up. And then finally, there's something called the Lamin gene, which has also been described and is a common cause of arrhythmias. So how common are cardiomyopathies? Well, there actually turns out that dilated cardiomyopathy, although I said it was 1 in 2,500, of course it depends on how much LV dysfunction you need to have before someone will let you call it a cardiomyopathy. In fact, in our country, 14% of people have asymptomatic left ventricular dysfunction. So it's really not rare. That's a whole lot of people to have some decrease in LV function. And although, as we said, ischemic and valvular myopathy are not in the current classification guidelines for a true cardiomyopathy, most of the working groups suggest that they be ruled out before you really consider what the cause of the cardiomyopathy is, which is usually then found to be a combination or one or more of either viral or genetic. In fact, 35% of patients who have a dilated cardiomyopathy is of a genetic basis. The next slide I'm going to show you is a table. It's going to be pretty daunting, but purposely so. So this is a partial list, not a complete list. This is a partial list of some of the things that can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. So you can see for infectious disease, I'm sure many of us have seen or know that HIV is now felt to be a common cause of myopathy. And also if you skip over to antiretroviral drugs, you can see that a lot of the treatments for HIV can also result in a cardiomyopathy. There are many bacterial cardiomyopathies and even mycobacterial diseases, not just TB, but atypical mycobacteria, M. avium, kansasi. All of those can also result in a cardiomyopathy. Certain nutritional deficiencies, one of them that I think is somewhat interesting, so I'm going to mention the others at various points also, but selenium deficiency is actually, there's a syndrome of it, and it's called Keshen's disease. And what causes it is there are some areas of Southeast Asia where selenium is not in the soil. Everywhere else in the world, pretty much, selenium is in the soil. So what winds up happening is it winds up, therefore, being in the vegetation, winds up being, you know, in eaten by herbivores, and those herbivores sometimes are eaten by omnivores. So the point is that all through the food chain, there are trace amounts of selenium, except if it's not in the soil to begin with. So in certain areas of Southeast Asia, there is no selenium in the soil. And not all of those patients who then develop cardiomyopathy. So if it was just on the basis of the fact that they had a nutritional deficiency, you'd expect everyone in Southeast Asia in those areas to have a cardiomyopathy. They don't, because in addition to having the nutritional deficiency, they also now have been found to need to have a genetic predisposition to certain viral infections that then, if they have the selenium deficiency, then goes on to cause a cardiomyopathy. I just thought that would be kind of interesting. And also, you know, so you can see collagen vascular diseases, infiltrative disorders, There's many genetic disorders that can result in a dilated cardiomyopathy, and we're going to discuss some of the miscellaneous ones later on as well. So that's just the end of that. Okay, so restrictive cardiomyopathy. Restrictive cardiomyopathy is, as I said, is the rarest, believe it or not, cardiomyopathy in our country. It's fairly common, we're going to discuss toward the end of this slide, in other countries, and I'll tell you why that is. But in our country, it's relatively rare. It's characterized in general by non-dilated ventricles. Sometimes you can have hypertrophy if the primary process is infiltrative. So, for example, with amyloid, sarcoid, hemochromatosis, Fabry's, and I'm going to discuss Fabry's again a little bit later, then you can have hypertrophy and still wind up that the main problem is diastolic filling in a usual hemodynamic pattern that you see in patients that have restrictive disease. So, for example, in general, for most of us that don't have a restrictive cardiomyopathy, we have a predominant filling of our left ventricle during the rapid filling phase. There are three filling phases of the ventricle. The first is the rapid diastolic filling phase. The second is a slower diastolic filling phase. And the third pretty much conforms to the atrial contractility phase. So what really is causing the filling of the ventricle is the transmitral gradient in end diastole between the left atrium above and the ventricle below. So anything that increases the diastolic dysfunction of the ventricle is going to increase the end diastolic filling pressure of the ventricle and decrease the transmitral gradient between the atrium and the ventricle. So therefore, when the mitral valve opens up, there's going to be less of a gradient, so less of the blood is going to come down during the rapid diastolic filling phase and also the second phase, which is sort of a trickle phase. And there's going to be more dependence upon the atrial contractility to fill the ventricle. So that's what's usually seen in people that have a restrictive cardiomyopathy, which may occur with infiltration and hypertrophy, or it may occur on its own. There can be different morphologies. So systolic function is often preserved, and including even right ventricular systolic function. So, for example, a lot of times these people are able to mount right ventricular systolic pressures that can be 70, 80. I'm mentioning that because even if it's not on this slide, one of the most common difficult differential diagnoses to make is between restrictive cardiomyopathy and pericardial constriction. So with pericardial constriction, many of you will remember you get a pericardial knock. You can get an M pattern on the right atrial tracing. You get Kussmaul's sign. But in terms of differentiating that between that and restrictive cardiomyopathy, it's often based on more aggressive hemodynamics, because what I just mentioned can actually be shared by some patients that have restrictive cardiomyopathy as well. So what you really need to distinguish often between constrictive and restrictive, sometimes you simultaneously load the left ventricle and the right ventricle with fluid. And if they track within 5 millimeters of mercury between the two of them, that's most consistent with constrictive disease rather than restrictive disease. Also, constrictive disease tends to have lower right ventricular, and which conforms also to pulmonary artery systolic pressures. So if you see that the pulmonary artery systolic pressures are greater than 55, that's more indicative of a restrictive cardiomyopathy than constriction, because in constriction it usually is less. And also the ratio of the end diastolic right ventricular pressure versus the systolic pressure is less in people that have constriction. So they're closer. The pulse pressure in the right heart is decreased in people that have constrictive physiology as opposed to restrictive physiology. Okay, so that's not even on the slide. Sorry, I burdened you with that, but I thought it might be interesting. Okay, so how do you make the diagnosis? You can do it by Doppler or new things, which are tissue Doppler evaluation, which can help make the diagnosis of diastolic dysfunction. I did say that restrictive cardiomyopathy is less common than dilated or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy occurs approximately in 1 in 500 people, and we said that dilated cardiomyopathy, it's about 1 in 2,500. If I can digress, I can tell you that with right ventricular dysplasia, it's about 1 in 5,000. So this restrictive cardiomyopathy is uncommon, but it's variable depending upon where you ask. So it can be caused by non-infiltrative, infiltrative, storage diseases, diabetes, often and sometimes scleroderma. Now, in the tropics, for example, in Africa, India, South Central America, and Southeast and Asia, there's a restrictive variant of something called endomyocardial fibroelastosis, not to be confused with endomyocardial fibrosis. endomyocardial fibrosis coupled with Loeffler's endocarditis are two eosinophilic syndromes that can infiltrate the heart muscle. But endomyocardial fibroelastosis is a different disease where often it's associated with in very young children with congenital heart disease. And the thought being, and this is another one that is multifactorial in terms of causes, it's commonly seen in people that have carnitine deficiency, maternal lupus with congenital AV block, but then there's also genetic, viral, and anoxic etiologies for it. And in general, it's diagnosed in biopsy. Now, most of the endocardial abnormalities, if they're strictly endocardial abnormalities, do not make the diagnosis of cardiomyopathy. Because if you remember from the beginning, I said that it has to involve the heart muscle itself or the interstitium around the heart muscle and therefore affect the heart muscle's ability to do its thing. And so if it's just the endocardium, then it's not necessarily doesn't make the diagnosis of cardiomyopathy. But in this case, there is involvement usually of the myocardium. And so the way the diagnosis is made is with biopsy, and also on echo you can see dense endocardial echoes, and with MRI you can see hyperenhancement. But this is very common in these areas, and those people can have a variant of the disorder that is a restrictive cardiomyopathy from involvement of the heart muscle in addition to the endocardium. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a clinically heterogeneous disorder, often inherited. We discussed when I showed you that picture that often there's hypertrophy of the septum out of proportion to the posterior wall, usually by a ratio of 1.5 to 1 in order to be diagnostic. But it can also involve the right ventricle as well. So you can often, and it can be concentric. The hallmark, in order to say that it's a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, is that it can't be secondary to the loading conditions of the ventricle, like we said before. So you can't have a patient who has aortic stenosis or has hypertensive heart disease, and they have a thickened heart muscle, and they have a gradient, let's say, you know, so as people often might with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and then say that they really have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. No, what they really have is hypertrophy secondary to LVH or valvular heart disease, which is not a cardiomyopathy, in spite of the fact that they may or may not have a gradient. So 25% of patients who have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy do have gradients, and greater than 50% have gradients on provocation. So what's provocation? You know, it's not where you get them mad and say, okay, now show me your gradient. So, you know, what we do is amyl nitrate often, which decreases the filling pressures, the filling amounts of the left ventricle, and anything that decreases left ventricular filling in people that have the physiology of what we used to call IHSS when I was training but no longer is. Anything that does that increases the gradient. Anything that increases the inotropy, which is the squeezing characteristic of the left ventricle, increases the gradient. So things in general that you can do to bring out a gradient in someone that doesn't have a resting gradient, but you're suspicious that they have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, is you can do squat to stand. You can look at the release phase of Valsalva. You can give them amyl nitrate. Any one of these things will decrease the loading characteristics of the left ventricle and therefore increase the gradient and hopefully show you a gradient. Now, I did want to mention that up to 70% is autosomal dominant with incomplete penetrance. So I guess that means that you should, in general, look at first-degree living relatives. That's been the classic recommendation in people that have hypertrophic myopathy, is you should survey first-degree living relatives to see whether they have this. The problem is that when do you do it? And if you do it and they don't have it, does that mean that they really don't have it? And the answer to that is no, because there's a phenomenon now that's been acknowledged in the literature called delayed morphological conversion. And what that means is that people can wait till adulthood to express the gene and produce the hypertrophic myopathy with or without the gradient. So if you survey them once, let's say they're 20 years old, and you say, oh, they don't have it. It was autosomal dominant, so we probably would have seen it by now. The answer is no. So it's not clear, but probably every couple of years, people that are first-degree living relatives should be reassessed or genetically assessed, because they may in fact have it but not have expressed it yet. Now, there are two common mutations. I said it was autosomal dominant with incomplete penetrance, but the two common mutations are the beta myosin heavy chain or the cardiac myosin protein C genes. Those are the two mutations that commonly result in hypertrophic myopathy. And on biopsy, what you see often is myocardial disarray. So, for example, in people that have volume overload of the left ventricle and consequently left ventricular hypertrophy as a result of that, it's usually an eccentric hypertrophy. So the myocardial fibrils line up like this, whereas they line up more in series in people that have concentric left ventricular hypertrophy, which is based on usually an afterload stress on the left ventricle, so something like aortic stenosis or hypertension. These people don't really do that. They just have myocardial disarray. And they can present with those four common things, which are very problematic, interestingly, because syncope in people that have IHSS, if it's not due to an arrhythmia, is not necessarily prognostic. And arrhythmia evaluations in people that have hypertrophic myopathy are often flawed. So electrophysiology studies can often yield false positives and false negatives in people that have hypertrophic myopathy. And CHF is sometimes very difficult to treat. So if they don't have class 4 CHF by New York or Killip, whatever you're going to use, then really you've got to be thinking twice when you're beginning giving them diuretics and when you're going to be giving them things that are inotropes, because you actually can increase the gradient and worsen the CHF. Although if someone presents with a classic severe CHF pulmonary edema, then you're supposed to treat them gingerly, but the same way as you do any patient with congestive heart failure, and that would mean diuretics and sometimes even inotropes if they have, in the end stages of many of these things, they wind up with a dilated cardiomyopathy, so it really depends on what stage of the disease they're in. So the differential diagnosis includes athlete's heart. That's a tough one because they used to say that athletes are in general produce eccentric hypertrophy so that you could, and usually those people have dilatation out of proportion to the degree of left ventricular hypertrophy. But it's actually been shown more recently that that's not true. There's certainly a subset of athlete's heart that are concentric hypertrophy, that are small ventricles that may or may not have a gradient, although most of them don't. And then if you proscribe exercise, you tell them that they shouldn't exercise for some time, a lot of them will have regression of the LVH, which people, of course, who have true genetic hypertrophic myopathy would not be expected to have. And here, there's a couple of genetic syndromes. Noonan's is a facial cardiac disorder. It occurs in children. They have ASDs. They have pulmonic stenosis. Friedreich's ataxia is not very common. Pompe's is an acid maltase deficiency that results in deposition of glycogen into the interstitial areas around the myocardium and decreases heart function. And mitochondrial disease is another disorder that can sometimes produce left ventricular hypertrophy with or without a gradient. And finally, Fabry's disease. I did say that I would talk more about it later. I guess later could be now. So basically, Fabry's disease is an X-linked recessive disorder where you have a decrease in alpha-galactosidase A, and that leads to a sphingolipid deposition actually in the cardiomyocyte. And they wind up getting true left ventricular hypertrophy. And it's also has been felt to be a systemic disease. So it, in general, is thought to involve other organs. But more recently, it's been shown that it doesn't have to, and you can get, and that isolated myocardial involvement from Fabry's is not rare. So the next one, this is number 4, is arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy, arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. The hallmark is fibrofatty infiltration of the right ventricle, often the free wall. You can often see this on MR imaging, sometimes on an echocardiogram. If you recall the last echo that I showed, there was a markedly dilated hypocontractile left ventricle, and sometimes that's what you see. But up to 75% of them can have involvement of the left ventricle, sometimes even leading to a cardiomyopathy. The hallmark, the pathognomonic finding on the EKG in people that have arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia is the epsilon wave, which I'm going to show you in a minute. But that there are other variants. So people can have a Brugada syndrome variant where they have right precordial ST elevation and a right bundle branch block, and they have arrhythmogenic right, and they have the same arrhythmias, which in general are left bundle branch block arrhythmias with a superior axis, because remember, it's originating in the right ventricle, so that means in general you're going to have a left bundle branch block. So, and there's something called desmosomal genes. I'd mentioned that before. I'd mentioned Lamin genes and desmosomal genes. Up to 60% of patients who have arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia have desmosomal gene mutations. The most common there are other genes that can do this. So most of them are autosomal dominant. There are four gene mutations that are autosomal dominant. There are autosomal recessive varieties, and there's also a variety that's called the RYR2 gene. And the RYR2 gene codes for something called ryanilin. And what that is, it's a protein in the sarcoplasmic reticulum that's responsible for calcium transport. And there are certain much more common arrhythmias that are associated with that abnormality, but some of the people that have arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia also have that abnormality. And although it's the most common form of sudden cardiac death in Italian athletes, in our country, the most common cause of sudden cardiac death is hypertrophic myopathy. So, and then the last thing that I wanted to mention, just because a lot of the cruises, if you know, I know that Dr. Seckler goes on a lot of cruises, and if you go to cruises through the Greek islands, sometimes you might wind up at an island called Naxos. And on Naxos, they have an autosomal recessive variety of arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. And it presents with woolly hair. So these people tend to have woolly hair, and they have palmar plantar keratosis. And they die at a young age as a result of arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia unless they have an ICD. So that's just it's relatively recently described. Now I'm going to try to go back. I did sort of suggest that there is a more pathognomonic finding that is sometimes seen, though sometimes not, in people with arrhythmogenic right ventricular cardiomyopathy or dysplasia, and that's the epsilon wave. And the epsilon wave is actually this little notching right here at the very tail end of the QRS and the very beginning of the ST segment. And that when you do see it, it should raise the suspicion of arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia. And then I'm going to briefly discuss some unclassified cardiomyopathies, the first being left ventricular non-compaction. That's basically from arrested embryogenesis. The blood supply that goes into the adventitia doesn't make it all the way through the media. And what happens is the muscle of the left ventricle is loose and spongy with a lot of small interconnecting sinusoids and recesses. And you can wind up with thrombus formation there and embolization. And because the heart muscle is not working very well, they can wind up with heart failure. And there's also associated other congenital defects, most common being coarctation of the aorta and bicuspid aortic valve. The next thing I want to talk about is ion channelopathies. This is actually very, very interesting, I think, because it's a departure in some regard from what all of the other cardiomyopathies are. All of the other cardiomyopathies have a sort of an obvious structure functional abnormality. So on an echo, on an MRI, on pathology, the myocardial disarray, you're going to see something, either antemortem or postmortem. But with the ion channelopathies, these are felt to be cardiomyopathies that are based on small protein abnormalities, which are also often genetic. And they change the channel of some electrolyte. And as a result, are usually causing arrhythmias and sometimes heart block and things like that. But there's nothing on gross inspection of the heart or even micro inspection of the heart that you yet are able to identify. So it's really on a molecular basis. But because it does change the structure and the function of the heart and it is a primary problem of the heart, it technically makes the diagnosis of cardiomyopathy. So when I was training, which was very, very long time ago, there were two long QT syndromes that we had to memorize for our boards. One was Dravet-Lang-Nielsen, which was autosomal recessive and had and deafness, and the other was Romano Ward, which was autosomal dominant and did not have deafness. And then by the time it was time to take my boards for the second or the third time, they had three long QT syndromes. So long QT 1 and 2 were potassium channel abnormalities. Long QT 3 was a sodium channel abnormality. I'm sure that now they're up to 8 or 9 total long QT syndromes. So that, you know, and people can have the sudden death that they can see with those things sometimes while sleeping, sometimes with certain sudden stimuli. It depends on which QT syndrome they have. An interesting point is the long QT3 syndrome is actually the paradoxical reverse of Brugada syndrome. So there is something called the SCN5A locus mutation. And when that allows the sodium channel to be hyperfunctional, then that can produce long QT3, when it stays open long enough so that more sodium is able to be transported through it. When it's sluggish and less sodium gets transported through it, then you can often get Brugada syndrome. So, and Brugada syndrome, you may or may not have the characteristic right precordial ST elevation with a right bundle branch block. Sometimes you don't have it, but you have a family history of it or you have other suspicion of it, and then you can give a sodium channel blocker, which will then further decrease sodium conduction through that already slow channel and bring out the Brugada waves. So that's all I'm going to say on long QT syndrome. Short QT syndrome, so those are people that have less than 330 milliseconds of a QT interval. And the only thing that actually will show up on a routine EKG in these people, and they also die of sudden cardiac death, is that they tend to have peak T waves. So similar to people that have hyperkalemia. And importantly, molecular basis for what's felt to be going on is consistent with hyperkalemia. So there are three different potassium channels that are thought to be hyperfacilitated. And so extracellular basis, you might not have hyperkalemia, but you might have functional intracellular or pericellular hyperkalemia because of these three potassium channels that are hyperfunctional. And that's why you still see the peak T waves, and those people can also die of sudden cardiac death. Brugada syndrome, I already discussed. There's this entity, catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. In general, all you see there is a tendency to bradycardia on the surface EKG with or without U waves, actually. And that is due to, I mentioned before, this RYR2 receptor that codes for ryanilin, which is a protein on the sarcoplasmic reticulum that is involved with calcium metabolism. So, not calcium, calcium transport. So in these patients that have an abnormality or a mutation of that gene, they wind up having what we call catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. And what happens is that during periods of startle or during exertion, they can have sudden cardiac death. And the last one is idiopathic ventricular fibrillation, which really nobody knows enough about. We don't know what the channelopathy is of that one yet. There's several postulated mechanisms, but the final phenotype is an idiopathic ventricular fibrillation. So only two more cardiomyopathies to go. So the next one I want to talk about a little bit is stress-induced cardiomyopathy, also called Takotsubo. This actually came to our country, and the first diagnosis was made as recently as 2005. So it's a relatively recent diagnosis. And when I was first learning about it, I think it was Dr. Seckler that said, well, it's due to from apical ballooning, that it roughly translates into apical ballooning syndrome. But in reality, that on further look, that's not true. Most of the things Dr. Seckler says is true, by the way. So, he's very smart. But in fact, what it really means is cage or trap of the octopus in Japan. That's how it roughly translates. So, but basically what it is a stress-induced myopathy, which now that we're more cognizant of it, we're seeing how common it really is. So I think we've all had patients that have come in with what sounded like an acute coronary syndrome, and then they were cath and they didn't have significant disease, or they had no disease feeding a larger area that would be expected to have a lot more coronary disease. So you can make the diagnosis of Takotsubo in the presence of coronary disease, but in all cases, the degree of wall motion abnormality has to extend beyond the territory of the vessel in question. So in the past they thought that one of the causes of this was a wraparound LAD, and then they found that most of the people that actually had the syndrome in fact didn't have a wraparound LAD. So if you have an area that is has a little bit of thrombus or has remodeling on a positive remodeling on a CT scan, and it involves a wraparound LAD, and that territory anteroapically is akinetic or dyskinetic, then it's very hard to say that this is a Takotsubo. But if you have disease in the right coronary artery or in a small ramus, and you wind up with a big anteroapical wall motion abnormality, then that is consistent with Takotsubo. So usually there are EKG changes similar to that you would see in acute coronary syndrome, but in general the troponin level is lower than what you would see in a corresponding acute coronary syndrome, and the CPKs often are only barely elevated. So, people don't look at CPKs very much anymore, so really what I'm talking about is CPK-MBs, but the CPK-MBs usually are not
are not significantly elevated. Now, I reviewed one study that I thought was very interesting just to be able to highlight how common this is. So in this particular study, they looked at 92 patients that were in the intensive care unit. And they looked based on clinical criteria and echocardiographic criteria for Takotsubo syndrome, and they found that 26 out of the 92 patients had it. So that's 28%. So that's not in any way rare. And the only thing that when they backed up and looked through multivariate analysis that correlated with those that developed the Takotsubo was sepsis, which is obviously a very big systemic stress. So, you know, it's very common in women. The classic is, you know, women that are under a lot of stress. It can be recurrent, 10%. The average duration of the wall motion abnormality is 7 days. So, you know, it usually, and it is believed to be possibly some sort of myocardial stunning. So the various explanations for what's going on are that you can have epicardial coronary artery spasm, you can have small vessel or microvascular spasm, there can be endothelial dysfunction, so it's not really clear that it's the same mechanism in all patients, but and you treat it often the same way as you would an acute coronary syndrome. So if someone has a paradoxically moving anterior wall, and you would have the same fear of thromboembolism that you would after a large MI, and I put these people on Coumadin, you know, until that wall motion abnormality goes away, and sometimes life vests if they have cardiomyopathies until their LV function improves. And the last unclassified cardiomyopathy that I'm going to discuss this morning is cirrhotic cardiomyopathy, which didn't exist when I was training, so I knew nothing about it until I did the research for this talk, because I knew about alcoholic cardiomyopathy, but this has nothing to do with alcohol. So alcoholic cardiomyopathy is similar to rate-related cardiomyopathy, or to cardiomyopathies and nutritional cardiomyopathies, are cardiomyopathies that in general can be reversible. So, you know, people can get a rate-related dilated cardiomyopathy without ischemic heart disease, just from the rate, and then you can slow them down, treat their pheochromocytoma, treat their hyperthyroidism, and their LV function can improve. Nutritional deficiencies, removal of toxins, those things can do that. And alcohol was felt to be a toxin that can produce a temporary cardiomyopathy, and when patients stop drinking, it can go away. Cirrhosis, on the other hand, whether it's from alcohol or non-alcohol, produces, in general, a permanent cardiomyopathy that's non-dilated. And these people also have some relatively consistent type of arrhythmic issues going on. They can wind up with prolonged QT and consequent torsade, and they can wind up with chronotropic incompetence, which is similar to cardiology incompetence. Okay, so now I'm going to briefly, and only briefly, because I've been talking for 45 minutes, so within the next four or five minutes, maybe 10 at most, I'm going to go over everything sort of on this slide, which is the last slide, and then I'll take about 5 minutes of questions if anybody has them. So diagnostic and treatment considerations, and some of these we can go through relatively quickly. So we discussed that there's primary and secondary cardiomyopathies being associated with another syndrome or disease. So find that disease. So if you find that disease and you treat that disease, sometimes the cardiomyopathy will get better. So that makes good sense. Obviously, you want to get a very good history. So if somebody has traveled to endemic areas and they have a right bundle branch block and they just came back from living in a thatched hut in South America, well, then they probably have Chagas, which is, as hopefully many of you remember, is a bite by a reduvid bug, a kissing bug. Yeah? And what this just out of for curiosity's sake, what this bug does is it doesn't have anything in its saliva. So what happens, or even in its stomach, it has a posterior area, I think they might call it a gizzard or something like that, but it has a peculiar abnormality where it defecates while it eats. And so what happens is that in the fecal material from the bug is the Trypanosoma cruzi, and you rub it in, you know, because the bite is irritating, so you rub the fecal material from the bug into the wound, and then that's how you wind up with Chagas. If it bites you near the eye and you rub it into your eye, you get a swollen eye. And you know what that is?
Romanus.
Excellent. It's called Romanus sign. So you know, and if they have toxic, you know, you have to look for toxic insults. And in the 1970s, there was a rush to have the best beer between, I think it was Anheuser-Busch and Coors. And what they were doing to beer was they were putting in cobalt because cobalt makes the head of the beer much more luxurious. The problem is cobalt is also a cardiac toxin. So people were developing cardiomyopathies from drinking beer, and it had nothing to do with the volume of the beer. It wasn't related to the alcohol. It was related to the cobalt. So you want to look for toxins, the infectious things that were on the list, malignant, if a patient has a history of malignancy, chemotherapy, radiation can produce a restrictive cardiomyopathy, in some cases a dilated cardiomyopathy. Pregnancy, if they were just pregnant either the month before the end of the pregnancy or 5 months after, then you have to think of the possibility of peripartum cardiomyopathy. So I want to talk a little bit about endomyocardial biopsy because that's a way that we make the diagnosis sometimes of what's going on. Now, when I was training, which was a very long time ago, we were often thinking of myocardial biopsy as a treatment in search of a disease. There was a Dallas criteria to look for people that have myocarditis, but it was felt that most of the time, if you could make the diagnosis at great risk to the patient, there was very little you could do with the findings that would improve their prognosis. That's all changed. So it's changed with increased ability to isolate viral DNA. It's changed with increased ability with immunofluorescence staining to identify infiltrative disorders, to identify white blood cells and which white blood cells are there. And so now, whereas it used to be thought of that and recommended by major bodies that you should really only consider endomyocardial biopsy in people that have sort of progressive heart failure and are developing cardiogenic shock and you don't know what's going on, that's felt now not to be the case. It's felt that people that just have, you know, cardiomyopathy with any clinical suggestion that this could be related to myocarditis or an infiltrated disorder, that they should have a biopsy. It could be right heart biopsy, left heart biopsy. Usually you need to get 3 biopsies. There's recommendations in terms of how you quickly formalin fix it. But you can make the diagnosis in a vast amount of patients, and you can change their prognosis. So, for example, in people that have inflammatory infiltrative cardiomyopathy, if they also have positive viral stains, their prognosis is not great. If they have a infiltrative inflammatory process and their viral stains are negative, their prognosis is better. And in addition, if you give them steroids and Imuran, their prognosis is very good, whereas those that had viral abnormality there, viral DNA there, not necessarily so much. And you can also make the diagnosis of things like hemochromatosis, sarcoidosis, Fabry's, you know, all of these other things with endomyocardial biopsy. So the risk now is felt to be less than 0.8%. So it's really not a very risky thing to do for the information. That's why the thought process has evolved. So if you can't figure out what the cause of it is, then, I mean, if you can and it's something reversible, then obviously the way to treat it is to correct the deficiency. If people have a thiamine deficiency, a selenium deficiency, a carnitine deficiency that we said can lead to endomyocardial fibroelastosis, if they're low in niacin, we can give them back that stuff. If they have toxins, including heavy metal, lead, lithium, cobalt, mercury, we can remove the toxin. If they have a tachycardia, we can address the tachycardia, either the cause or put them on beta blockers. If they're alcoholic and coke or use cocaine, we can ask them to stop, though we all know they're not gonna. And we can treat the underlying, you know, diseases, if they have a collagen vascular disease, if they have an infection, if there's an endocrinopathy. So otherwise, if none of those things work out, then we're really down to treating the results, you know, which is heart failure. So if that's the case, then, you know, we all know the treatment for heart failure. You know, we would give DIG, except if they had amyloid. Okay, because amyloid actually sensitizes the myocardium to digoxin, so that's a relative contraindication to giving digoxin. Another contraindication would be a patient who has hypertrophic cardiomyopathy with a gradient, because you're going to actually, by giving them a positive inotrope, you're going to increase that gradient. And interestingly enough, when I reviewed the literature for heart failure treatment, because I wanted to do that before I gave this talk, it was interesting to find that beta blockers are still only a class B recommendation in terms of treating cardiomyopathy-induced heart failure. So class A recommendations are ACE inhibitors and ARBs, and even addition of ARB to ACE inhibitor trumps beta blocker in terms of the weight of the scientific evidence in support of it. So, you know, but we all know what the medications are, diuretics if they're fluid overloaded, new medications like Entresto, I'll mention, which is very good and now on formulary here. And also diet, you know, so you want these people on a low-salt diet. If you can, you're going to fluid-restrict them. I've never found fluid-restricting patients to be particularly beneficial because they don't usually follow it. If they have on the basis of ischemic heart disease that can't be revascularized, there's some data that a Mediterranean diet can be helpful. Exercise in people with cardiomyopathies does not change prognosis. It does not decrease mortality. It increases their subjective feeling of wellness. And so it's certainly recommended, but it's not necessarily something that is going to improve mortality. Transplant, if they're young and if they don't have any other comorbidities that would preclude them from transplant, people that have transplant are now living longer. I think it's something in the range of 80% 10-year survival, 90% 5-year survival. So transplant has certainly come a long way with new immunomodulatory techniques so that people can treat rejection and identify it earlier. Defibrillators, as primary prevention, we know from the MADIT studies and SCUD-HEF that people who have an ejection fraction under 35%, no matter what cardiomyopathy or ischemic cardiomyopathy by MADIT under 30%, that if they get a defibrillator, you can decrease their likelihood of having a ventricular tachycardia and an arrest secondary to that. What percentage of patients actually would have an arrest if you didn't put in the defibrillator? So in other words, how many patients do you need to treat in order to save one life by primary prevention data, it's 17%. So about 6 patients need to be treated for every one life, for every one event that would otherwise be potentially life-threatening. And then the next thing that I'll mention is biventricular pacing. So actually in 1997, 1998, 2 studies came out back-to-back. One was the companion trial, and then there was something called CARE-HF. Both of them looked at very sick patients that were class 3 and class 4 congestive heart failure, all had an ejection fraction of 30% or under. And what was found was that they decreased the rate of hospitalization, decreased overall and cardiovascular mortality by putting in biventricular devices in those patients. So they improved left ventricular function by biventricular defibrillator. And more recently, there was the MADIT CRT trial. And the difference between that was in the first trials that I mentioned, you needed to have a QRS restoration of over 120 milliseconds. And that was revised in the MADIT CRT to 140 milliseconds. So now you need 140, 150 milliseconds of QRS duration with a cardiomyopathy in order to qualify for biventricular pacing. And the final thing I'm going to mention is a left ventricular assist device, which used to be thought of as either a bridge to transplant or in some cases a bridge to nowhere. Because a lot of people were getting left ventricular assist devices. They didn't last for a long time. The patients were dying anyway. They were on transplant lists. They didn't get their transplant, and they were dying with left ventricular assist devices. Left ventricular assist devices have come a long way. Everything about what I just told you is now archaic. So there are basically 2 different types of left ventricular assist devices. One of them is extracorporeal, where everything is outside. The generator is outside. The only thing that goes into the patient is actually the tubes. And those are used in general in people that are after a bypass, that are tough to get off pump, have LV dysfunction. And interestingly enough, what's been shown with those is that the duration of hospitalization, or until they no longer need the device, has gone down when they have continuous flow as opposed to pulsatile flow. So now people are doing studies on the internal devices to see really whether you need to have a pump or whether it really is more physiologic just to have the flow. So it seems that with the external devices, all you really need is the flow at whatever, 4 liters per minute or whatever the cardiac output is supposed to be. But pulsatile flow doesn't give you more and, in fact, may give you less. And then now there are better internal left ventricular assist devices. In general, what happens is the left ventricular ones, there's right and left ventricular ones. The left ventricular ones hook up to the left ventricle at sort of the tip of the apex of the left ventricle on the opposite side of where the aortic valve is. And so when the left ventricle squeezes, it is able to push some of the blood out through the aortic valve, and the rest gets pushed out the other side into the business end of the left ventricular assist device, which then contracts and forces the blood not through the heart but the other way, and then that's connected to the aorta just distal to the aortic valve. And it's been found that if you do that with the new devices that have longer batteries, they're smaller, they used to only be able to treat, larger patients. Now we can treat, smaller patients, even kids, and they can actually have long-term survival of years with a left ventricular assist device. So now it's thought of as a destination, not just a bridge to something else or a bridge to nowhere. And with that, I'm going to stop and take whatever questions you might have. Yes, sir. The answer is genetically, you can screen them once genetically, you know, because, you know, you can, there's a whole bunch of gene subtypes. There are four, 60% of them have this desmosomal gene abnormality, which is readily found on genetic study. And there's four different mutations that they can have, which they can identify those mutations. And then there are rare recessive forms that can also be found, including this Naxos, you know, syndrome that I mentioned, and also this RYR2 gene mutation that can be identified as well. So it really is identifying it genetically, because what we now know with this delayed adult morphoconversion issue, that with most of these things, not seeing it when you look doesn't mean you're not going to see it years later. So really, all of these people, if they have a first-degree living relative that has one of these anomalies, they need to have gene counseling and gene investigation.
So if the genetic tests are negative,
then they don't have it. I mean, if they identified what the gene was that she had. Okay, then that's a problem, because the point is there's many. I didn't want to put the slide up there because everyone would have just looked at the slide and then left, because it's very busy. It actually, if you remember, the dilated cardiomyopathy slide was 1.5 or 2 pages long. The genetic slide is like 5 pages long with different gene types that can all lead to the same phenotype. So if you don't know what the genotype was that she had, then you can't test, you know, effectively for the first degree living relative to know that they don't have that, and it could be another one, and you just haven't found it. So you'd have to basically survey periodically just to look for abnormalities.
And how long would you survey them?
I mean, you know, there's no delayed morphologic conversion that can't be later. So theoretically, it's something that it could occur at any time in life. So I would, you know, every couple of years. The same as if I had somebody that had an abnormal aorta with Marfan's. You know, it's not known, but I probably would check them every 2 years for the rest of their lives. That's a very good question, because, as you know, based on the Dynamite trial, we're not supposed to be putting in ICDs within 41 days of an acute coronary syndrome or myocardial infarction. So the question is, does Takotsubo really qualify as an acute coronary syndrome or not? So if it does, if you put it down there on the piece of paper that this is an acute coronary syndrome, then, or anyone does, then you are not going to be able to get a defibrillator within 41 days. Medicare won't pay for it. But if you say specifically that this is a Takotsubo myopathy, then you might be able to get it earlier, but it's still then a cardiomyopathy that then is a what we used to call a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, okay? So in general, the dictum for that is you have to wait 3 months or 3 months after revascularization. So a lot of times, no matter what you call these things, because they come in acutely, and especially with a Takotsubo, because what we said is the average time to resolution is 7 days. So you don't want to put in a defibrillator and then 7 days later the wall motion abnormality is gone, they don't need it. So what I do in those patients is I put on a life vest. Okay, thank you very much.